These are African rhythms, passed down to us through ancient spirits. Feel the spirit, a unifying force. Come on, move with the spirit. Stand up, clap your hands. Move with the rhythms, get down.
From WSNC 90.5 FM, a broadcasting service and NPR affiliate of Winston-Salem State University, welcome to Africa World Now Project. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. Today, we explore the socio-political conditions in Somalia. Africa World Now Project is next. The geopolitical conditions within which Somalia was born cannot be divorced from the conditions that institutionalized themselves in 1884-1885. It is during this conference held at Berlin, commonly known as the Scramble for Africa, where European white supremacists decided it was their right to divide the lands upon which they had no real affinity other than economic motives. It was here the geographical region of Somalia was divided into three parts: British Somalia, Italian Somalia, and French Somalia. British and Italian Somalia gained independence in 1960, immediately uniting, forming Greater Somalia. And French Somalia, with great irregularities, voted to remain under French rule, and subsequently gaining independence in 1977, becoming Djibouti. Other historical influences that produce current Somalia are located in the conditions that surround the periods when the Ethiopian Empire took over Ogaden and Kenya took over the northern frontier district regions. The subsequent conditions generated by exacerbating and fomenting divisions among various groups of people who live in the region are important to understand, as they are directly impacted by the conditions within which the people live today. To erroneously label Somalia as a failed state instead of a collapsed state distorts the how and why the region is in this state of intentional conflict, accelerated at the behest of Western foreign capitalist interests that have historical roots in the many attempts to control the region. That is, the wars between European cultural groups and the socio-political cultural others they created as enemies. To be clear, upon closer analysis, the real threat of the region is the fact that the people of Somalia are really showing that the nation state is not the only system upon which peoples can organize themselves. What do I mean? The people in the region have been functioning against the imposition of foreign structures that have caused internal conflict for over 30 plus years. If they were allowed to organize themselves on the trajectory they were on before the intentional and aggressive efforts of Western nations to destabilize the region for its own economic and cultural ends, Somalia as we know it would be what it once was erroneously labeled, the Switzerland of Africa. The reason I say erroneously labeled, but still useful to highlight the point, the model should not be a European nation, as this label dismisses the deep logics and socio-political histories of African peoples who organized themselves into civilizations before the creation of the nation state itself. And the peoples of Somalia, despite the distorted narrative and images, are a testament to this fact. Today, Africa World Now Project's Moisa Mutali is in conversation with Abubakar Arman. Abubakar Arman is a former diplomat once serving as Somalia's special envoy to the U.S. As a Somali political analyst, he has widely published on issues related to foreign policy, Islam, the Horn of Africa, and extremism, among other topics. Our show is produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descended communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, and Ghana, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all peoples. Enjoy the program.
Abubakar Arman, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
First, I just wanted to, before we get into all the nuts and bolts of the situation in Somalia, July 1st marked 60 years of independence of Somalia. And after years of political instability and civil war, and if you could give us a broad aspect of the country as we start our conversation, where do you see Somalia today, and where is it? Do you see it going?
That's a very critical question. You're right. It's been 60 years since independence, and Somalia's been in in a roller coaster of emotions, and from the day of winning the independence, it was a glorious day. The country started with a democratic system that lasted about 9 years, and then there was a coup, and then military government that lasted for 21 years. And then since then, it's been a civil war, almost 80 years. So that has been the history in a nutshell. Where it is at now, you said, if that's the question, then, well, that's the controversial part. I have his strong views as far as where things are going now. I just wrote an article about a month ago addressing, or at least taking a realistic approach as to the current system. The status quo is not really healthy either for Somalia nor for anybody else who is interested in its well-being. So what I suggested was that because things are becoming, the nation is becoming so divided along clan stands, little fiefdoms that are dominated by one particular clan, I call them alpha clans. So in order to streamline our problems, and our problems are many, economic, political, social, in every aspect. So in order to streamline all of that, I suggested maybe it's time to just accept the UN and everybody else in the international community that are occupying basically small area within Mogadishu that's referred to or called Halane, H-A-L-N-E. H-A-L-A-N-E. So that's like the green zone type of place where you have the good, the bad, and the ugly. And they're the ones who finally dictate to these guys in suits who are supposed to be the leaders of Somalia, who's supposed to be advancing its interest and so forth and so on. In order to streamline all of those problems that I cannot really sum up all together, I suggested that maybe it's time to just formally request that we are placed, we mean Somalia entirely, including the regions that are now either claiming secession or semi-autonomy. All of them, they have their own presidents right now. We have close to seven presidents now. To put them in a four-year, similar to trusteeship, a painful word to even remember or bring it to the forefront, but that's what's happening already. But this time, the only difference is you don't have anyone accountable. You have a group called International Community that dictates Somalia under the umbrella of FENFOM, the UN umbrella, basically, within that green zone. So my suggestion was then, why not just accept that reality and say, okay, we surrender to that reality on the ground, but we want one particular country to be responsible with all these billions of dollars that are spent on a daily, the $1 billion is spent on tablets, donut nations and all of that. Invest in Somalia, so to speak, but no one knows where it goes. The government gets a fraction of that. Everybody else gets the chunk of it. Mostly it goes in towards security, most of it like contracting the subcontractor and the subcontractor will contract another subcontractor, and the list goes on and on and on. And at the end of the day, the same thing goes, by the way, for the on the humanitarian front. Nothing reaches the end recipient or the person who's supposed to be getting in the first place accept fractions of what has been donated. So I was just saying, provoking actually the conscience of a dormant nation, basically, because most of us are guilty, including myself. I mean, a lot of us who are supposed to be being in the forefront in terms of generating ideas or enlightening the public, we don't do as well as we're supposed to be doing that. So this was intended to awaken the dormant conscience of this nation and tell people that, look, we are really in this predicament. And if we continue with this, we can continue another 1,000 years and nothing will change. Our situation would be worse. We would be dependent militarily, economically, politically, on foreign powers, basically, to dictate Somalia what needs to be done for geopolitical reasons and other reasons. So that was the article that I referenced what it's all about. And that sums up what the painful 60 years that we have lived through, between hope and despair, basically.
But I also wanted to expand on what you were talking about. I think in the article you mentioned that you were alluding to is Shock Therapy for Somalia, which you wrote on June 23rd, and that was in the Foreign Policy Blogs. But also, if we could expand a bit more on how the role of the international community has played throughout all these years, because remember, one has to remember how in the Cold War, the U.S. supported Somalia at one time. Of course, before that, there was the former Soviet Union, and there was a lot of weapons that was dumped into the country. How has that also been very much the kind of the background, also the foundation of some of the crises today, when you're looking at all the weapons in the area as well?
Yeah, well, let me separate those two questions and answer them differently. Number one, as far as the UN is concerned, there are different times in the course of Somalia's existence where the UN played a major role in terms of really lending a helping hand, at least in the umbrella. Something that comes to mind is in the early 90s, as you may recall, when Somalia was really in a terrible shape. This was the peak of the civil war and the death of especially children, and together with the civil war and famine, were causing over 5,000 nationwide death of children. And at some point, Bay Deborah area and all of that was the triangle of death, where really a lot of people were suffering greatly. So the involvement of UN and United States of America at the time was really positive. They played a major role in really trying to help Somalia get back on its feet. But that's... Yeah, ever since, of course, there are different phases when the UN was not really playing a major role since the Civil War, especially after post-2004, ever since was not really positive. It was just sustaining the status quo. Their base was in Nairobi, and millions and hundreds of millions and billions of dollars disappear every year, extravagantly squandered everywhere in private star hotels and private jets or planes going to place to place. And there's a long history of that, which is really negative. Then comes into partnership with tributary nations that are mostly European nations and some Middle Eastern, and a combination of those, of course, found a good umbrella under the UNSOM right now, the current one that exists. So is that a positive? No, I don't think it is a positive. In fact, I wrote an article prior to the one that you referenced, which was, in other words, saying it's about time to end that relationship. So Somalia is not a rogue nation that has to be forced against its own will what the Security Council wants. That's for nations that are not adhering to the international law. But Somalia is a country that's really adhering to all of those things. It has no problem. It's fighting the same fight that everybody else wants to fight. So it has its own sovereign will to exercise, but you have to have the right leadership for doing that. But do we have those leadership now? The answer is no. As far as the geopolitical situation of the past, vis-a-vis now, the current one, you're absolutely right. Somalia has been always a pawn that was used on one hand, the Soviet Union, the old Soviet Union, versus the United States, or call it NATO and Warsaw. And it was part of that chess game, basically, as a pawn that's expendable. And it still is, but and so these are some of the things that Somalia and Somalis need to awaken to. And there's nothing wrong to be part of this geopolitical game that the big boys are playing. As long as you know what is happening and what role you have and how does it interest your own country. Is that on the table now? The answer is no, it's not. And that's why I was saying that things has to change. We cannot continue the way things are right now.
And I wanted to go, we were talking broadly, but I wanted to get back to like what's happening now, but wanted to give some a little context as to what's happening. That's why I wanted to ask that broad question about where do you see the country now? Is it, and we got into the geopolitical aspects, which I probably would like to expand a bit better later as well. But we've had on the ground, there was supposed to be elections taking place soon in the country, the presidential and parliamentary elections, but they've been postponed. They're the first direct elections for the first time in 51 years. And this postponement has actually even led to the resignation after a no-confidence vote of the prime minister. How do you see that affecting the political dynamics of the of Somalia, the resignation of Prime Minister Hassan Kari?
Well, that resignation is it's a whole chapter in of itself. Things are not exactly the way they appear from the surface. By the way, the election has not been delayed yet. There's an attempt from the current administration, president, and his office to push towards that an increase in their term, an extension, if you will, because they're dangling in front of the people the one person, one vote. And I was open before, and I would be frankly stating it here, that nothing like that would happen in Somalia very soon until you find the right leadership who can contest again the very same group that I just described, the Halana group or the so-called international community, or those who give cover to the predatory capitalists of all kinds. The reason I say that is because already this government already signed a lot of deals, and so did the previous one, in fairness to them, so did the previous one. Lots of lucrative deals for these predators, if you will. And right now, the term is ending with this government. In the past 3 years, it was ranked the lowest in the world as far as production is concerned, the very bottom. And so one person, one vote puts all of those deals that they have at risk, because they cannot dictate who would be coming out as a president if the nation goes into one person, one vote. Is it doable? The answer is yes, it is doable. The secessionist region in the north, Somaliland, which claims it's independent of Somalia, although still officially it is part of Somalia, has been conducting one person, one vote for the last at least two elections, I believe. So it is doable. But the issue within Somalia is nobody in Helena, nobody in that green zone wants it. And they would find the right corrupt people, find the right amount of money that they can use in order to buy parliamentarians to re-elect them or elect a new person that could represent them well, which, by the way, the previous prime minister was one of those. He was a representative of a group called Soma Oil and Gas. And they won the largest, the most coveted deal in the oil and gas business in the world for free, basically, without investing a cent in it. So somebody still paid them some money, actually. And they have all of that deal signed onto them. Is it corrupt? Yes, it is corrupt to the core. And can it be reversed? Yes, it can be reversed. But who is it going to reverse? Not the perm guys, they're not. The ones that are in line most likely are not, because they're not even opening their mouth or they're not even indicating that they're interested to do so and so forth. So the Helena group, the group that I referenced, or the Green Zone group, if you will, are not interested in the one person, one vote. So the current administration uses that to dangle in front of the public and say, hey, guys, you don't want one person, one vote. Who in his right mind would object? So give us the extension. The extension is to finish all these unfinished businesses with these other corrupt people that they have been dealing with. And I hate to say this, but I have to be blunt because we're running out of time as far as Somalia's existence is concerned. And things have to be straightforward. We cannot be diplomatic the next 10 years or 15 years to really find this country under the ground.
So you would say that what the opposition's saying, because they're also very leery of the announcement from the Electoral Commission that they should be an extension of the vote, that it should happen next year. So it was scheduled for December and I guess also February. The parliamentary elections were for December and then February is the presidential election. So you also would be in agreement with the opposition groups saying that they're worried that this is just an attempt to an extension of the term of President Mohamed Abdullahi Farmoj.
Well, yes and no. Yes, I am in agreement, but I'm not in agreement with their ideology, nor do I think that they're the right people to represent this country at this stage. The most vocal ones are presidents of the past, especially the one who was there before Farmaggio. And that's the one who signed, by the way, the deal that I just mentioned on Soma Oil and Gas. He's the one who granted it. So, the opposition is not an opposition. And that's why exactly I would go back to the provocative article that you referenced, the shock therapy article. Because if Somalia is waiting for these guys to really change the status quo, then we're in for another nightmare, another 4 years of waste, wasted 4 years. And that does not serve the interests of that nation that suffered long enough. So yes, on one hand, I am in agreement with them when they say the voting has to take place at the end of the term without a single day added to their term. I'm in agreement with that. What I'm not in agreement with is the way they work, the way they see things. They still think that the system in place, they can operate in it just fine. And I'm saying the system itself is the problem. The system has to change. When I say the system, I'm not talking about just the Somali side. I'm talking about the international side as well. So both has to be overhauled. So it would require a bold political move on the part of the opposition. And I do not see that among the ones that are most vocal as far as the opposition is concerned.
Yeah, and going back to what you mentioned about the international side, expanding on what the role of the international side, we did talk about, of course, the role of the U.S. a little bit, but expanding a bit, especially now, you see the U.S. also playing a heavy-handed role in using drones, for instance, which they're saying that they're trying to squash al-Shabaab. But there's also been reports by human rights groups of how these drones have also, you know, civilians have been killed because of the drone attacks. If you could expand a bit on how the use of these drones, how they impact in the Somali life.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is the irony. You know, U.S. policy towards Somalia, again, as I said earlier, there has been some positive moments like the early 90s and all of that that the U.S. played. But in recent years, let's say the last decade or so, ever since drones were employed, ever since this drone diplomacy, so-called drone diplomacy, was applied to countries such as Somalia, Pakistan, and all these other countries. Somalia now, I think they just did their 43rd or 44th strike within this year. Now, we are in the 82nd week of the year. Divide that 43 times to 32 or whatever, you'll come up with 1.4, 1.5 times per week. So, in other words, more than once a week, the U.S. is bombing one particular region in Somalia or one particular area and saying that we killed X number of Shabaab. Okay. Meanwhile, innocent people die. Initially, of course, the Pentagon was denying that. AFRICOM was denying, I should say. But lately, when more and more people were confirming what was happening on the ground, they kind of came out and just said, oh, yeah, there was a one person who was killed, or two people here and there, you know, without really paying any compensation to the families or, you know, paying for the last soldier that was killed, or land and houses, you know, homes that were destroyed, none of that. So is that a positive policy? The answer is no. I called it openly many times. It's a failed policy. The whole thing that the $700 million the U.S. base named AFRICOM, it cost, I think, roughly around $700 million, I think, when it was being built. It really worked compared to what China is doing in Africa. For instance, you know, and 10 years later, it's just, actually more than 10 years, it's now 13 years. It was 2007, I think, or 2008 when it was commissioned. So about 12 years. All that period, the AFRICOM was a base that was floating in on the oceans, in the ocean, probably in most cases, and the Red Sea, and just shooting, you know, using drones every week or every other day in one part of Africa. So is it really worth it, the way they're spending the taxpayers' money? I personally don't think so, but who am I? I'm not the one who makes that decision, but I'm the one who analyzes and suggests what I think is right. Now, U.S., meanwhile, is not gaining anything in terms of PR in Somalia, although they're saying, yeah, we're fighting ourselves.
We are currently listening to a recent conversation between Africa World Now Project's Moise Mutale and former diplomat and political analyst Abubakar Armon. Abubakar Armon is a former diplomat once serving as Somalia's special envoy to the U.S. Currently as a Somali political analyst, he is widely published on issues related to foreign policy, Islam, the Horn of Africa, and extremism, among other topics. Our show is produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descendant communities of Standing Rock, Venezuela, Cooperation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, and Ghana, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all peoples. Continue to enjoy the program.
PR is Somali, although they're saying, yeah, we're fighting Al-Shabaab, you know. Sure, you're fighting Al-Shabaab. So is the government. You know, Al-Shabaab, the government is not liked, and definitely the U.S. policy is not liked, according to the greater public. Now, when you're talking about the leadership, that's a different story, because it's a marriage of convenience, and everybody likes what's going on and keeps quiet, and occasionally even gives cover. They give cover to the strikes, to AFRICOM, when they do the strike, the government would say, oh yeah, we were part of that. We knew about it, you know, and we helped them. You know? So things that are so ridiculous. These are guys that can even control within, let's say, about a kilometer behind the Villa Somali. You know, it's a Shabaab controlled area. So why are you fighting Shabaab in the periphery when they're occupying right there in Mogadishu? And that's a question that neither the U.S. side of the policymakers or the AFRICOM group can answer, nor can Villa Somalia, which is where the president and the administration is based.
So you think that these attacks, apart from, you know, of course, they're hurting civilian lives, as we see, and you also see them as also being actually fueling Al-Shabaab as well, giving it more life.
Sure, there would be killing Al-Shabaab, but if every strike had killed X number of Al-Shabaab, there wouldn't be Al-Shabaab by now. You know, let's be realistic. There has not been a single picture. Do you know how sophisticated the U.S.'s threats are, like when you're fighting against a legal war against another country? You know, they always show you the crosshairs and you know, how they targeted this one plane or this one tank or whatever, and then missile is fired, you know. You get all those things, you know. And here, you don't even get any, you know. The only thing you get is a statement that the phrase was attacked or, you know, drones fired missile in such and such place, X number of Shabaab were killed. Who verified X number of Shabaab were killed, number one? And could we not at least see their picture before? You know, those guys roaming around and doing a camp here and there, you know, and plotting to strike this place or that place. Give us some story that follows so it would be deeper. But now it's dismissed, you know, by the average person. There they go, you know, because they don't have a policy. The policy is just to shoot more. And President Trump already said that from day one. And he said, we will increase, we will double it. You know, okay, we will double it and we will increase. Did that stop Al-Shabaab? No, it didn't. Al-Shabaab is more dangerous today than it was 13 years ago or 10 years ago. You know, since 2007 when they were first, when we found out about their existence, right? They were part of the radical wing of ICU that slid with the ICU once they start making agreement with the government and that sort of thing. So ever since that time, we were saying we're going to eliminate Al-Shabaab. Okay? All right. In those days, it was 2,000, 3,000 maximum. The exaggerated numbers were like 3,000 Al-Shabaab, radical, you know, Somali Al-Shabaab that exist. Well, let's count them today. You know, are they 3,000 or more? I just told you that they occupy even the of Mogadishu. And the periphery, if you go to Afgoye and Barilla and all of these other places, they control it fully. You know? And a person wants like his property to be secured, the owner of that, because the government is so corrupt that some of these judgments that they pass, another guy would come, like your own house, or the government says you own your own house, right? You paid somebody to say that, and it is your own property. Another person can go behind you and pay extra money to the same judge or that same, you know, official. And then they will issue another statement that says, I own your own property. You know, your property, I the owner. I mean, I'm the owner because I paid somebody else. You know? So, but if you go to the Shabab area, Shabab will write you a letter that says, this guy owns the property, period. You know, nobody goes after that. Why? Because somebody's going to get hurt if they do that. And people understand there's law, you know, harsh as it may be, but there is. So the average person, the average house owner or property owner, who do you think they would trust, the government or a Shabab, to make that decision for? You know, they will go to the Shabab and they will say, just go ahead and write me this and just tell everybody that I own this property and I can flash it in front of whoever shows up at my door. You know, the government does not have that authority. So what's the purpose of those drones then, other than increase the number and other than further create more hate towards America and increase the anti-Americanism and so forth and stuff? What purpose? That's why I say it's a failed policy that the U.S. has to come up with a better foreign policy towards Somalia and towards the region, by and large.
Again, we're speaking with Abubakar Amen, who is a former diplomat and he is serving as a special envoy to the U.S. and has written extensively. He focuses on foreign policy, Islam, and the Horn of Africa, extremism, and other topics as well. We're looking at Somalia politics and COVID-19 and other issues affecting the country today. And speaking of before we get to COVID-19, I wanted to talk to you further about the other international players, because we have, of course, we talked about the USA, but then we also have Ethiopia as well, and Turkey as well, and another aspect. If you could elaborate a bit more about the other countries that play a role in Somalia's fate, and also. One could say that some of those countries, a lot of the countries have liked the status quo as is and have been helping really perpetuate this current situation.
Right. And as far as, let me start with Turkey. Turkey is a country that came to Somalia actually officially in 2011 at the peak of the humanitarian disaster at the time. And they showed up, in fact, at the time, President Erdogan was the prime minister of Turkey. He came with his wife and a few of his cabinet members, landed right there in Mogadishu when everybody else was saying Mogadishu was the most dangerous city in the world. Where the U.S., again, I'll go back to the, remember I told you there's a good side of it and a bad side of it, the bad side of it. At the time when Nairobi was the base and the money was being spent in there left and right without any accountability. And by the way, there's no accountability to this very day as far as the UN expenditure is concerned. But going back to Turkey and its role in Somalia, he came, President Erdogan at the time, Prime Minister Erdogan, he came and he announced and challenged the rest of the world and said, why are you not coming to Somalia? I mean, if you want to serve this country, why in Nairobi? Why are you in elsewhere? Come and land here. I'm right here with my wife and with my family. And he brought other of his children. I don't recall when. I mean, what? I mean, who? In any case, so that really turned the spotlight on the international community. So they were petitioning, basically. And then various countries started coming and showing, and hence the Halame got reinforced. Before, it used to be just intelligence and security and those kind of things. It was a no-go zone in the city itself. Still is a no-go zone, by the way. In any case, so it was a positive development. Now, Turkey, when they came, they were very adamant, and they did not want to have anything to do with the international community establishment, where the money were, you know, funneled through the UNPOL at the time, which was the UN office, and then that money just disappears. It never leaves Nairobi in most cases. They didn't want to have anything to do with it. So they donated or allocated about $500 million, I think, which was about $500 million, and invested it to be invested in Somalia. Their investment to this day, from 2011, is the most visible in Somalia. The roads that they built, the hospitals that they built, you know, the institutions that they have helped establish, and so forth and so on. You can look at the physical intake. There's the second, third, fourth, fifth. At that point in 2011, the international community, on record, spent about $50 billion in the name of Somalia. Not a single road was built. Not a single school was built. Not a single well was built or dead. Nothing to show. Everything was just spent right there in Nairobi. You know? And that was the way things were until Turkey showed up. So the Somali people, by and large, are indebted and recognize what Turkey has and really appreciate. To this day, Turkey is trying to reform from decisions that are made by the collective body, so-called international. You know, they have a different relationship, strategic relationship with the government, regardless of which government comes. And they don't side with one or the other. That's been their policy, and that's been successful for them. Whereas others always have one favor group over the other. Overtly or covertly. And many of them fund this group against that group, or this administration against that administration, and what have you. So that's as far as Turkey is concerned. As far as Ethiopia is concerned, now this is the part where we really get sensitive, because the previous government was the one that, is Ethiopian government, is the one that really did most of the damage to Somalia. They literally supported every group on the ground against the other group. Every group. So they had their network, so a sophisticated network that was really supporting practically every group. Every guy who gets angry at another politician goes to Addis Ababa. And he gets, and most of them, by the way, all of them are he, so that's why I'm referring to them as he. They get one reassurance or another, one type of funding or another, one type of armament or another. Ethiopia was never giving cash to anybody, but armaments, certainly, you know. We're running out of bullets. Here are the bullets. We're running out of guns. Here are the guns. And so forth and so forth. So it has that kind of like, there are few people who were loyal, few within the leadership who are openly loyal to them, and now the new government is kind of sidelining them because they know the relationship that they had with the previous government, and you know the change with the current government vis-a-vis the old one. So it's a very strange relationship that Somalia now has with Ethiopia. On one hand, there was a great deal of celebration when the system changed, or at least it appeared that it changed, depending on what you call the system in Ethiopia. And then the new president, Abiy Ahmed, came, and everybody was celebrating. I personally took a different approach to it. And the article that I wrote about the euphoria that was underway at the time, and then questioning the motives and the strategies that are driving, because everything was going like 300 miles per hour. And we know, you and I know, that neither in politics nor in geopolitics, things are done that fast. Things have to develop, you know. But when you have a one president that's going to one country, you reach, you know, the deal is done, we're friends, we're going to build, you know, and we're going to connect all these streets, and have all these highways, and we're going to have this wonderful, wonderful economy going back and forth, and everybody's celebrating. There is something always wrong with that kind of picture, because, you know, in that fast pace, you know, it's that time to keep your hands on the steering and make sure that you slow down a little bit, kind of assess how is that beneficial to you and to other people. And then under those circumstances, Somalia, of course, the current administration, that is, they signed four ports for Ethiopia. And Ethiopia, as you know, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, it bought some kind of merchant ships and all of that, that no one knew what kind of ocean we'd be floating in. You know, and sailing or traveling. Now we know, you know where the strategy was, you know, what the strategic target in Ethiopia was making. So is that beneficial for Somalia? No, it's still not the exact same thing I described earlier when I was talking about its own resources and how things were signed, because some leaders wanted either you know, put kickback or whatever the case, you know, and I have to be blunt. Some kind of economic protection, you know, and so forth and so on. Or they got twisted by the big guys, and there are big guys involved, from the U.S. to EU to the Gulf States to a lot of different people. So, I mean, that's the way I see Ethiopia part. Do I think the relationship is healthy? I certainly don't think so, especially what's going on within Ethiopia, the relationship between the current leadership and the Somali leadership and the Oromo leadership. Initially, it seems like they were all in harmony, but right now there's none of that exists, because as you know, Abiy Ahmed is losing his own political base, which is the Oromo support. He does not have that now, and nor does he have the deep state support within his own administration, if you will. So something is about to snap in there. I hope not. I hope there's no civil war in Ethiopia, because that's going to be disastrous for Somalia as well, and the whole region for that matter. I hope nothing like that happens. But I do think that it's not sustainable, what we see in Ethiopia, and it definitely would impact Somalia in one way or another.
And yeah, and I guess the leadership you're talking about is the new prime minister. Well, he's not new anymore. The current prime minister in Ethiopia, Abiy Ahmed.
I didn't catch that. I'm sorry.
You said you're talking about the current Ethiopian prime minister. That
correct?
Yes, that Abiy Ahmed.
Yeah, Abiy Ahmed is the one I was talking about, the one that does not have the political base, and the one that was going 300 miles per hour in reference to Abiy Ahmed.
And also, if you could touch a little bit also about the role Djibouti has played as well, because they've been in your article, you talked about this reconciliation attempt that's been taking place between Somalia and Somaliland, and how Djibouti has played a role in those type of attempts of trying to bring the countries together.
Yes, and you're right. Because there was a hoopla about so-called reconciliation conference that took place in Djibouti a couple of months ago. Again, I would go back to what I was just saying about development in Ethiopia. Anytime you see in politics things developing so fast and you don't have any hint of what really happened. And people just show up with their jackets, nice Armanis and so forth, and say, we're going to sign a deal. And that should be something of concerning to any logical, any objective analyst. So I put myself in that position of really being taken a skeptical approach to this whole thing. And lo and behold, that's exactly what happened. The whole thing was just a big hoopla for nothing. And it was just my argument was that this was a big extravaganza that was set to make sure that certain deals are signed on the sideline. And these other guys were given big carrot, each one of them, that you're really, in Somaliland, the big carrot was that you're going to be declared independent. And to Somalia, it was like, you're going to make up with your brothers in the north, you're going to be unified into one country. And neither one materialized, of course, as we know. And then a few days later, the Somaliland is going way to the other side of, you know, and so did Somalia, by the way. They're exchanging some kind of hostile rhetoric here and there and so forth and so on. And this is sort of as usual, basically, what they spent and how many millions they wasted. Because realistically speaking, if you want to bring people together, I said it a number of times, we cannot do that with international audience presence. Like if you were, for example, as in, to understand the nature of the nation or nation state, we have to first understand the nature of people. If two people have some issues and they were really angry at one another or they weren't talking to one another and you're the third person who's going to make peace between them, and you call them to your place, now it would be one thing if you are have a trust on you and you as an individual and everybody's ready to put it on the table. Now, when you bring an audience of the other person from the neighborhood, other person from outside, and you just say, come on, guys, join us. We're going to be watching these guys making peace. That itself changes the dynamic. And that's exactly what happened in Djibouti. You know, and President Margiela posts on his Twitter account, says that the day after tomorrow, we're going to be holding a just grand meeting where we're going to bring Somaliland and Somali together. I'm just paraphrasing what he said. And then he says on the second tweet, or the same tweet, if I recall it, he says, oh, by the way, I just invited also Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed to come by. Okay, and you wonder, what's going on? I mean, what does Abiy Ahmed have to do with this? And if you're going to bring these two, and why is the third person? Wait a minute, it wasn't Abiy Ahmed. It was everybody else in the green zone of Mogadishu that I mentioned to you that showed up also. The U.S. had a presence, EU had a presence, everybody else did. And now you have two guys not been talking to one another, suspicious of one another, and you have a foreign audience surrounding them, waiting for them to make a deal. You know, what kind of deal are they making? Who negotiated that? No one knows. You know, and then at the end of the meeting, they said, okay, we agree to form a committee from each side. Okay. That committee has been in existence the last 5 years. They met in Istanbul, Turkey, more than twice. And they made some agreements there that were never fulfilled. What happened to those agreements? Are we starting all over again? You know, the whole thing was just an embarrassment, to say the least. So that's what I think of the Djibouti conference.
And before we go, I also wanted to touch on situation concerning COVID-19, coronavirus, and how it's affecting Somalia. First, I mean, how it's affecting it. Health-wise, we hearing. I'm not sure if this fairly. I'm not sure how accurate the reports are. So some figures that seem to be extremely low, and people have suspected that they're probably artificially low, that they're not fully accounting for people who are really affected by COVID-19. If you can elaborate on that a bit more.
Yeah, I mean, everything is going to be on a guesstimate basis, because really there is not an official tracking in Somalia. The government neither has the capacity nor the means to do it, nor the will to a certain degree, because the public outcry was during Ramadan that they wanted to implement the toughest social distancing and, you know, quarantines, if you will, or that nature. But none of that materialized. People wanted to go ahead and go on with their businesses. And rightfully so, by the way, because the reason I say rightfully so, in the first world, like, you know, in the U.S., for example, a country like this can afford to ask people to stay home, miss their work, and pay them while they're, you know, waiting for this thing fast, okay? In a country like Somalia, where people don't have, on an average, more than $2-3 per day, then you're talking about really, you know, harming some families based on, you know, kids die based on hunger, because if those family members don't go out and earn that $1 or $2, or in some cases, go into a family, you know, extended family member, and asking them for help, whatever, you know, they have to do in order to survive. If you prevent them from doing that, and the government cannot supply them with food or pay them X amount of money to survive, then you really are creating a bigger disaster than the COVID itself for a country like Somalia. So on one hand, the public rejection of not adhering or, you know, decided not to adhere to the government's instructions were valid. On the other hand, the government tried to stop the flights, and I think they resumed yesterday or the day before, I don't recall. So that was nice of them. That was good. And occasionally you see some government members wearing the masks and all of that as well. I'm good. Although other times you see them in conferences that arguing each other and not wearing them. So it's a mixed picture, basically, you know, the positive and negative. As far as the numbers of deaths and how it's really impacting the country, I don't really tell you that. I mean, there are smaller numbers according to the government, but then, you know, there's nothing to substantiate that. We're just going to hope for the best, basically.
And also, COVID-19 has also affected remittances, because Somalia depended heavily on the Somali diaspora remittances, particularly as it was going through all these troubled times when there wasn't like a functioning government. There was so much support from the diaspora in the remittances. How has that been impacted because of COVID-19?
You're absolutely right. It did impact, and that adds on to the pressure that I mentioned earlier. You know, and, conditions have changed. People who are sending money cannot go to places where they would send it, and those who could afford pre-COVID-19 could not afford, or people were frightened to save because of economic uncertainty. There are many reasons that really cause people or reduction of the remittances. So you're absolutely right. So add that to what I told you earlier, and then you can see how disastrous for the average family it would have been to just stay home and not take a risk. So we're going to take the risk. We're going to go out and really earn our daily living, basically.
And so the other situation, of course, we have in the region, in East Africa region, there's been this locust invasion, which has affected a lot of the crops in the surrounding countries and even Somalia. And how has it been affected the production in Somalia like the other countries? Has it been as devastating, the locust invasion in the country, as it been then as in other countries, like in Kenya and other parts of East Africa?
Yeah, it really impacted Somalia a great deal. I mean, the peak of it was several months ago, and a little less than a year ago, when it was really worse, and the central region had suffered the most. And the little vegetation that was there, and that's not an area where it's, you know, it's not just the central region, by the way, all the way to North Somalia it reached, but the one that was widely covered was the central region. But either way, the worst of it is behind us. That doesn't mean it did not really impact. It has.
That's it for Africa World Now Project for this week. I would like to thank you for joining us today and look forward to spending time with you next week. We can be reached through all your regular social media platforms, email africaworldnowproject@gmail.com, or follow us on Twitter at AFWRLDNWPRJ. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. The Africa World Now Project Collective consists of international media journalist, executive producer, and human rights activist Moise Mutale, Africa World Now Project media correspondent Funda Ngunda, senior research, content contributor, and production director Dr. Tasneem Siddiqui, senior researcher and content contributor and production associate Dr. Josh Myers, associate producer and content contributor Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, technology advisor is Byron Gray of GrayWorks Technology, and creative director is Judah Pope. Africa World Now Project is heard every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WSNC, NPR affiliate and broadcasting service of Winston-Salem State University. Shows are archived weekly on SoundCloud. Search Africa World Now Project. Until next week, be safe, be peaceful, and above all, be intelligent.